This is Peter Allen celebrating 75 years of a Met on radio. No Met opera season would be complete without music by Richard Wagner. From 1935 to 1941, his Tristan und Isolde enjoyed a crest of popularity. The Met presented the work with a team of Kirsten Flagstad and Lauritz Melchior 68 times, nine of them heard on radio. This duo of great voices, some may say the greatest Wagnerian voices of the 20th century, helped pull the Met from the doldrums of the Great Depression. In the ecstatic Act II love duet, time stands still when the lovers are reunited as Brangaena stands watch during the night. Here they are, Kirsten Flagstad and Lauritz Melchior, in the broadcast of January 1937. Artur Bodansky is on the podium. Just heard a highlight from 75 years of live broadcast from the Met.
Time for the Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera Quiz. Moderating this last quiz of the season is pianist Brian Zeger, who performs in recital this season with Susan Graham, Frederica von Stade, and Deborah Voigt. On the panel, Lotfi Mansouri, Christopher Purdy, and Karen Stone. Lotfi was just in Toronto, where he directed Wozzeck for the Canadian Opera Company. Next spring, he directs Boris Godunov and Samson and Delilah for San Diego Opera. Chris is executive producer of WOSU Public Media, based in Columbus, Ohio, and he's also completing doctoral work in opera production at Ohio State University. Karen is the general director of the Dallas Opera. Before coming to Dallas, she was the general manager of the theaters of Graz, Austria.
Good afternoon. Andrew Mikolajski writes us from his home in Long Buckby, England. I love saying that. A listener to the BBC, Mr. Mikolajski has noticed that set pieces are often introduced in opera in the manner of, let's hear a bit of singing. He would like the panel to consider quotes from various operas in which a character introduces one of these set pieces, either their own or another character's. Here's our first quote. Tell us who sings the following lines and who's about to sing in which opera. Here's our first quote. Va presto, la canzone che stamane amedeste a madama cantata. Let me translate first. Now quickly, the poem that you read to me this morning, sing it for madam, Miss Stone.
It's Susanna introducing Cherubino singing Voi che sapete.
Yes.
In The Marriage of Figaro, Act Two.
Thank you. Io questa sera ho la memoria piena di quella cantilena. This evening my mind is full of that song. Mr. Purdy was first.
That's the great Willow song, Salce, Salce from Otello. Desdemona sings that, sings beautifully for 10 minutes and then is murdered.
Okay. Ich sing sie selbst, hört Mädchen zu, lasst mich's euch recht zu Herzen führen. I'll sing it myself, listen girls, let me reach your hearts. Miss Stone's hand shot up.
It's Senta, and she's just about to sing about Flying Dutchman in that opera.
Which doesn't work out terribly well either.
It ends badly.
Yes. Viens là, écoute, et tu verras si j'ai perdu ma voix. Come over here, listen, and you'll see if I've lost my voice. Mr. Mansouri.
Antonia in Tales of Hoffman says that to Hoffman.
To introduce her.
When they end up singing together.
And here's a bonus one, because you've all been so good. I have a reasonable good ear in music. Let's have the tongs and the bones. And that is it. That is in the original language. You can guess it. It introduces a rather silly dance, actually more of a dance than a song, but there's often song with it. Mr. Purdy.
I have no idea, but that's the title of the memoirs of Harold Rosenthal, your countryman who was the founder of Opera Magazine. And nobody cares about this answer, I'm sorry, but that's just...
but I'm dying
it's
to know...
It's a good book, though.
But is the title, I Have a Reasonable Good Ear in the Music, or Let's Have the Tongs and the Bones?
The Tongs and the Bones, yes.
The Tongs, yeah, and the Bones. Tongs and the Bones. It's from a Britain opera, and it's in the repertory of this house.
Belly Bud?
No.
Albert
Another
Harry?
Britain opera in the repertory of this house.
Peter Grimes.
A Shakespeare text.
Oh, a Midsummer.
Oh, Midsummer Night's Dream. Okay.
And so who's calling for music? Can you guess from there?
Oberon?
It's Bottom. When Bottom is enchanted and he's with Titania, so he wants to have a little celebratory dance and
we've
song.
We've just missed Shakespeare is what you're saying to us, right?
Yes. Yeah. So let's move on to our next question. Some operatic characters like Ortrud in today's opera are hell-bent on revenge. Of course, this makes for some good red-blooded singing, whether the reasons for their revenge are justified or not. Elizabeth Duban Hansen, who tunes into WQXR from her home in New Jersey, would like you to identify some of these vengeful passages. I'll play the passages on the Yamaha. You tell me whose vengeance is being sung about in which opera and whether it comes to pass. And the first one's a giveaway. Why don't you all say it together?
The Queen of the Night.
Very good. Next one is a little harder. Now I have three hands. It's the honor system who got up first.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Mansouri.
Pizarro.
Yes.
That's when he is then, just before he wants to have Florestan killed.
In which opera, et cetera?
That's called Fidelio by Beethoven.
Thank you very much. Just for the sake of completeness. Yeah. Our third example. Mansouri.
Wouldn't be Brunhilde, would it?
No, you're in the right. Well, Brunhilde is in there.
That's what I thought. That's in the Götterdämmerung.
No, you're right. It's actually a rare case in the ring, which is a trio.
Yeah.
With the three of them.
But she's the top voice.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yep. Okay. Well, that fourth example. I think this calls for another ensemble response.
Rigoletto and Gilda. Is that her name? Yeah, Gilda.
It's her name.
Yes, right.
And this is very apt because it's Si Vendetta, Tremenda Vendetta, yeah. The end of the act. And our last example.
Oh, God.
I promise. Who was first?
It's Wagner.
No.
And don't say it's not Wagner.
Electra.
It's Electra, yes. Electra. I meant Electra. Yeah. I didn't mean Wagner.
It's Electra by
Wagner.
Okay.
It's the dancer. It's finally when she says when the vengeance is done on Clytemnestra and Aegisthus are dead, she's going to dance.
Yes.
And she finally gets to dance.
She does get her way, yes.
Right.
Many of you are familiar with Tom Stoppard's brilliant play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, in which these two minor characters weave in and out of Shakespeare's Hamlet. We've received a question along these lines from Tony Lazarowitz from Santa Barbara, California, where he sets his dial to station KUSC. He'd like the panel to imagine some operas retold from the points of view of their minor characters, and we've given this question to our panel ahead of time. Let's start with Ms. Stone. Can you give us your...
Well, I've always felt rather sorry for Ferrando in Trovatore, because he's given 4 minutes at the beginning of the opera to tell what Wagner would take 50 minutes for. And so there he has to tell a complicated story along the lines of there was a gypsy, this gypsy had a brother, the gypsy's brother died, but the brother who died never had a brother, so what relation was the gypsy to the brother who died? So I've always rather imagined that the rest of the opera is that at the end of that, the soldiers say, excuse me, just a minute, which brother was it? So he has to start explaining it. Meanwhile, the gypsies are singing, and so the opera continues. And at the end of the day, finally, then the new guard appears, and then he has to retell it to them, and he never has any idea. So a Dantesque vision of hell from the point of view of Ferrando, and next time he wants to be in a Wagner opera because he'll have more time to tell the story properly.
And perhaps they'll all get it straight this time, yeah.
And the audience will as well.
Yes, one can only hope. Mr. Mansouri, what was your imagined plot?
Well, actually, this is not a new idea, because years ago, Jean-Pierre Ponel, who was a fantastic stage director, directed a production of Flying Dutchman, where it was the steerman's vision. Mm-hmm. So everything was through him. So when I got this question, I started to fantasize of the characters. And another one, these are, by the way, all new ideas for any conceptual director who would like to steal it.
Okay.
I think Traviata, Anina. Anina's experience. I mean, she's seen everything.
She's seen it all.
She's been there. She suffered through all the pain of Violetta and all that. And then, of course, another one of my favorite characters that I would love to see the opera through his eyes is Spoleto. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's been in all three acts. He's one of the henchmen. I mean, he gets slapped around because he couldn't find Angelotti, and he's got his problems, you know, and everything like that. So there's a whole list of characters that I like to suggest to these conceptual stage directors.
And the Spoleto idea could have a wonderful kind of mobland quality.
Oh, it feels like I mean, Sopranos you to could me, go you know? On with yeah. Goro. Another yeah. one is the page in Salome. I mean, my God, he's got a crush on Naboth, and he's jealous of Salome. You could make another opera out of it.
And would you keep him a woman, a female?
Well, it's supposed to be a young man played by it's the same thing like Cherubino Cybele and all that. But I think that would be an interesting version of Salome.
Okay, Mr. Purdy.
We need an operatic version of American Idol, let's face it. You don't argue with success. I would take Valzacchi and Annina in Der Rosenkavalier, the gossip, scandal sheet sellers and fixers, two of my favorite characters in opera, and I would turn them into the producers of operatic Viennese American Idol, because you always have that marvelous tenor solo in the first act in the Levee di Rigori Amato, and it's either horrible or wonderful. It's never okay. It's all the guy. He's either butchering it, it's terrible, or it's magnificent. So you could have Mr. Mansouri be Randy. You don't know who Randy is, do you? Okay, never mind.
Valzacchi.
Hang on. Well, I did the footman, but well, I'm not. Miss Stone is Paula Abdul, and myself is Simon. Even though I don't have the pecs or anything, but I think that Valzacchi and Annina would turn into sort of these roadshow impresarios because they've heard what tenors sound like in To the Nobility, and hey, why not? You know, more's more.
Well, and they are guns for hire. They'd be good at any.
That's
put
right.
anything on.
There's a little catch here, because Valzacchi, being an Italian, he's very pro-Italians. And the tenor, remember, he's an Italian.
Yes.
And he sings, it's the only thing at Rosenkavalier, which is in Italian.
Right.
So I, as Valzacchi, I had to listen to a lot of bad singers, but I always had to pretend that they were singing beautifully.
Sure.
Because I was in Italian.
That's called acting.
Yeah.
That's
called acting, yes.
Let's move on to our next question. Stage designers are charged with creating a world in which the story of the opera is told and in which its characters dwell. Julie Ellison has written us to ask about stage design in opera from her home in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where she catches the broadcasts on the CBC. Can the panel name some productions in which the design worked powerfully in favor of the piece and counterexamples when it did not? Since we have a distinguished director on our panel, we hope to hear some inside stories about how some of these creative solutions came about, and I might also add a distinguished producer on our panel. So let's tell all, Ms. Stone.
Well, I'd just like to start off by saying there was a production of Rusalka that David Pountney did at the English National Opera, where he moved the whole thing into the 19th century, and there were three girls, children, asleep in an overlarge bedroom with huge beds. And there were magical French windows with net curtains blowing in and the moon shining through, and the floor opened up. and a swing came down, and she sat, and Rusalka sat on this swing with the curtains blowing and the moon, with her feet trailing in the water, singing the hymn to the moon. It was one of the most gloriously magical and poetic moments in opera. It was quite beautiful.
And simply done at the same time. That's
simply
interesting.
Simply done and modernized and taken in a different way, but my goodness gracious me, it was powerful.
And Mr. Mansouri.
Isn't that marvelous? Because in our profession, it's so much of a personal aesthetic, you know, when we like it. Because I saw that production, and I was bored out of my mind. Because it all happened in a kitchen, and that the witch was this cook. I mean, you know, and I had not read the program notes, so I didn't know what. I thought she was supposed to be a water nymph. I missed that water that you saw.
Oh.
The one that was on the floor.
Well, there you
Maybe
are.
My seat was not good enough.
You were on a dry night. Yeah.
So, anyway, no, but it depends. It depends on you.
Sure.
One of the productions that I remember was magnificent. It was Jean-Pierre Ponet's Cenerentola. Mm-hmm. It was so delightful. It was so witty and intelligent, and it helped the music and the drama and all that, because I love designers who really enrich the experience for the audience. Mm-hmm. They create the absolute right ambience for the directors to work in it and all that, rather than fighting the piece.
You don't believe in working against the piece, something tells me.
I don't believe in that. You know, I'm not, because I always, when they say this, what do they call them? Deconstructive, I would say it's not deconstructed, it's destruction. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, that's all of a sudden they put, they're supposed to be this beautiful room, and they put in a urinal or something, you know. And I don't understand why they do that, because I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Purdy.
I grew up watching the productions and learning from the late Sarah Caldwell, who just died a couple of weeks ago, who was fiscally impossible and could be brilliant as a stage director and a producer. And her War and Peace of Prokofiev back in 1975 played on a 30-foot stage in a converted porno house that they hadn't finished converting yet. And I was the stage manager, so I know what I'm talking about. And she had maybe 15 people in the chorus, and you would have sworn you were in St. Petersburg 200 years ago. She filled what space she could find with movement, with color, with sound in a way that I have never seen before or since. And you sat there and she did it uncut. I think it was the first uncut, fully staged production of War and Peace in this country. At least she said it was, and who knows? I mean, you know. But it was, and Donald Graham was in it. I think he was Napoleon, and all kinds of wonderful people were in that.
It's remarkable, and that's an example of great creativity on a
Absolutely,
real shoestring.
Because she did everything for $1.98, and she didn't have $1.98.
Yeah. You know, so,
but it was tremendous. I'll never forget it.
Yeah. Our next question comes from Lynn Curtis, a resident of Cincinnati, Ohio, who tunes in on station WGUC. She read recently about the retirement of some longtime classical music critics and the decision by their newspapers not to replace them with full-time classical music critics. She'd like the panel to reflect on the current state of musical criticism as it affects opera, with a couple of sub-questions. Do critics still play a vital role in the opera world, and has their role changed? And I can see this is a loaded question for this panel. Let's start with perhaps the least loaded, Mr. Purdy.
I'm the least loaded?
Well, just in that you're not in the business of putting them on and getting them reviewed.
It's probably my last quiz, so what are you going to do, fire me? I don't care. You know, it wasn't that long ago when an Andrew Porter could write 5,000 words that you could sit there and learn from a great deal about not only the production he saw and heard, but the piece itself and the genesis of the piece. And now if you get 500 words in review, you're quite lucky. And I don't think there's really many people out there equating with his writing ability. What's happened is that the arts in the print media, in my opinion, have become unimportant. And lip service is given to who, what, where, and when, and that's it. And, you know, that's the news business. I understand that. But when you talk about an artistic endeavor, which the reaction of which, as Lotfi said, is always different, and which is emotionally based, you can't do it in who, what, when, and where. You can't do it.
Okay.
So I think blogs and things like that are picking up the slack, but I think the days of Andrew Porter's kind of print journalism may be gone.
Yes. Ms. Stone, what's your reaction?
Well, I think I'd like to tell a story of a review of a Parsifal in London conducted by Reggie Goodall that Tom Sutcliffe in The Guardian gave a very bad review to. And it earned him from the Kundry Annie Evans in the crush bar of the Royal Opera House a glass of red wine poured over him in public.
You're not advocating this,
I think. I am not.
It's a waste of some good wine.
Yeah.
It's a waste of wine. I think the problem that I think is someone who runs a theatre, the difficulty is reading a review, which really is just a personal point of view, and it's a bit of entertainment. And when it's written down as gospel, that gets my goat.
Yes, and you do wonder if you've been in the same place at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you, Lotfi Mansouri, Christopher Purdy, and Karen Stone. This is Brian Ziegler returning you to our beloved Margaret Juntwait in the Metropolitan Opera broadcast booth.